Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, November 2nd, 2020, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. And yes, I know, tomorrow is election day for those of us in America. And no, I'm not going to get into it because I am not stressed at all about it. Not at all. If you want to see me vent, check out my Twitter. But in the meantime, we're actually going to do an awesome show today. Before I get into it, I do want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible each and every week. I'm going to give a shout out to my top patrons. If you want to be a part of this amazing group, just visit patreon.com/talknerdy. This week, I want to thank Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, Christopher Pitts, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Dudas Infinitas, Charles Payet, Brian Holden, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Robert Christ, and Elise Christie. Thank you all so freaking much. All right, this is a good one, you guys. I have the opportunity to speak with Dr. Emily Willingham about her newest book, Fallacy. That's fallacy with a PH, a little bit punny there. Fallacy, Life Lessons from the Animal Penis. Yes, I know, but we go a lot further. I'm not going to fall for that pun trap. A lot further than just the penis. This is actually, I don't know why you would be surprised, but a pretty deep conversation about a lot of really important things that we know as scientists, that medical professionals know, and what they don't know because of the history of how we have studied gender and biological sex within the animal kingdom. Dr. Emily Willingham is an incredible science journalist, and you have read her work, across so many different outlets, the New York Times, Scientific American, Forbes, The Washington Post, Slate, Discover, so many others. She's had a long and really interesting career in the sciences and also in journalism, and I highly recommend you check out her work. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Emily Willingham. Well, Emily, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So your book, it just came out about a month ago, and I'm super excited to be diving in to Fallacy with a PH, Life Lessons from the Animal Penis. The second that I received a copy of this book, I was like, yes, 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 we are definitely talking about this. And I have to say, I'm very, very excited to be chatting with you today because I read your like things that you write. Like I see your byline and stuff that I read all the time. So this is really exciting.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Of course. And you write for a lot of different outlets, right? I think I see you in Scientific American a lot, but like I share and read a lot of Undark and a lot of like, where else have you posted? I mean, you've posted in a ton of different places, but Washington Post. What are some of the outlets that you tend to write for most often?
I would say most often right now it's Scientific American. I've been, kind of sticking with them a lot lately. So, yeah.
And what kinds of different subjects do you mostly like to dive into? I mean, I know that you yourself have a PhD. Is it in like in straight biology or is it specialized in a certain kind of area of biology?
Well, this is a transitional question. So it's in developmental biology and I focused on gonadal development for my PhD. And then in my postdoc, it was in urology with a U, and we focused on how penises develop. So that was kind of the sort of, you know, premise for writing a book about penises, really. So,
How interesting! And so, during your graduate level work, I mean, and I don't want to like dig into when necessarily, unless you're comfortable talking about that.
That's
but how prevalent was learning about, you know, intersex and learning about gender kind of differences and biological sex differences as part of your kind of training and your research?
Well, we did spend a lot of time on intersex because the animals we were working with would develop both primary tissues, ovarian and testicular tissues. And so for us, that was just a, you know, common thing. We also worked with a species of lizard that's all female. They're parthenogens, and so they reproduce by mitosis. So all of these kinds of variations and the genetic pathways that lead to them were not novel to us. And this was in the late 90s. So, and then as we moved into this century, I love it that I transitioned across the century. But anyway, as we moved into this century, and when I was working on penile, on genital development, it was just, the clarity on the different directions things could go was, becoming more and more into focus. So
I love that. I mean, I feel like you probably had insight into what some of the potential social movements around gender are because you had so much training in biological sex. And it must be, or I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm wondering what it's like for you. Do you get frustrated? Do you get annoyed when you see the politicization or the pushback that often kind of is, is so prevalent in social media when non-scientists feel that they know best about, the human experience of sex and gender?
Yeah, there are two things that bother me about that, actually. First is that sort of biological essentialism that they tried to invoke to make these claims, and they're wrong. I mean, there's so many sexes out there. And so that's one problem, is it's anti-scientific. It's not biologically accurate. And the other problem is to sort of this position that if it's not biological, then it's not valid for human behavior.
Right.
And I have huge issues with that as well.
I see that a lot. I feel like in the kind of skeptic movement, which is a big part of kind of my identity and my culture, is that there's still this kind of firebrand essentialist group of individuals where it's like, if I can't test this in a placebo-controlled, double-blind, randomized trial, it is not valid. And it's like, are you kidding me right now? Like, philosophy is still valid. Literature is valid.
Yes.
Not everything, especially I study psychology. It's like, you can't test most things that way. That's how you test, like, drugs.
Right. You I mean, you can make predictions, right? And you can hypothesize, how things might be happening, and you can test those hypotheses, but not everything has to come down to that. And there are my favorite thing is when they take issue with this, like, the phrase, jargony phrase, ways of knowing. But I mean, what that really is that people experience the world in different ways, and not one way is more valid than another necessarily. And then I think that I see a lot of people taking issue with that. But what bothers me is the effort to constrain human behavioral expression, which has so many layers to it, to this sort of biological essentialism.
Right. And it's, I mean, I think it's pretty apparent for many individuals who have been lucky enough and privileged enough to take the time in academic institutions to study these things in depth, that when we stand back and we kind of take a global perspective, it becomes pretty apparent that the science is not driving the opinion in these situations. It really is that the kind of ideology is driving the, justification through science or attempts at justification through science.
People are finding the answers they want to find, and their biases are their signpost to that. So, yeah.
Well, and that, I think, brings us to is a good segue into this conversation about the penis and this entire book that you dedicated to not just kind of the biology, physiology, behavior of, what we can learn from the animal penis, but how that, of course, translates into the human experience, into the history of biomedical science, and what, the people who had the power chose to study, chose to ignore, blah, 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 blah. So this is such a big topic. And I think that you've done such a great job of, like, maintaining organization and focus. I can't imagine taking this on. And actually, in taking this on, producing such a kind of manageable book, if I could say that, like, it's not, it's not a tome. It's definitely readable, It's
thank you.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that.
Like, you probably had to kill a lot of darlings in this book, which
so many little darlings.
And you even made room for some schematics, which I love, because what's a book about penises without schematics?
True. Yeah.
So I guess obviously you already had an academic history in this area, but what inspired you now to sit down, compile this information, do the reporting, and actually write this book?
The biggest inspiration is just watching what happens to men in our society and the effects that impossible masculinity have on them. I have three sons, and I just try to imagine this sort of pressures bearing down on them. And a lot of those pressures seem to just sort of focus on the penis. I mean, look what has just happened in the news, right? I mean, we're recording this the day after, you know, a pretty high profile guy at the New Yorker got busted for Zoom dick. And, you know, there's a lot of focus on, everybody does this. This is a thing that people do, which, by the way, I don't need to know about people doing on Zoom. Like, you do you, but you don't need to make announcements about this. And,
right.
This focus on what he showed instead of why he did it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we, in general, need to take a step back away from conflating men with penises because, you know, a penis doesn't make the man, and a man is not just a penis. And look more and contextualize it more. So one of the things I try to do with this book, the life lessons from the animal penis, one of those lessons is that I think you're probably aware in evolutionary psychology, much is made of the penis and the shape. And there have been people who've written about it. It's a scoop that takes out sperm and some things like that. And I just try to contextualize our penis is sort of built more for intimacy, just based on the broad patterns in the animal kingdom relative to some of the kind of really banana stuff you can see out there in genitalia. So that's one of the things I try to do. And the other one is to emphasize that, you know, what we perceive as masculine isn't about having a penis. And as I note in the book, there are lots of species where the animal we would label as male is not the one that has the penis. So we need to step away from that and decenter that and look to our brains. You know, we opened this discussion talking about gender, and our brains are just so multifaceted and interesting, and our behaviors ditto. And we need to look more at how we express ourselves and how we can accept those expressions without boxing people in.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, from kind of a bird's eye view of history, it becomes readily apparent pretty quickly when you realize who throughout, you know, I guess we could say even modern Western science, but obviously there's so many centuries prior to that. But who was doing science, who was writing about science, who was studying whom in the laboratory or in the medical surgical theater. It becomes pretty apparent why the penis was front and center and the vagina wasn't, just because there was like a horrific sampling bias there that was, you know, I don't know if it was narcissism, I don't know what it was, but we do know men were doing all the studying. Men were, for whatever reason, really preoccupied with their own dicks and they weren't that interested in vaginas. And there's a lot to unpack there, but why? I guess the question that's like a really big question that I have no idea if you can answer is like, why are men so obsessed with their own genitalia? Like, why did Freud think that women had penis envy? You know what I mean? Like, where does this stuff come from?
Well, you know, it's an interesting piece of anatomy. I mean, it really is. I'd spent, you know, several years studying it. So obviously I find it interesting as well. I mean, it's a very interesting body part to have. I mean, I don't have it, but I can only imagine like everything that must get invested in it, right? And then, I mean, they worry about how long it is, how big around it is, how does it compare to anybody else, what's the angle of the erection, all these other things. And then they're told by society that this is what matters, that these are all factors that matter in, you know, your relationship with a partner and whether or not that partner will be satisfied, especially if that partner has a vagina, and that it's, you know, putting that penis in the vagina is what matters, you know, to that partner. And it's all extremely misleading. But it doesn't surprise me that the people who, I mean, all up until quite recently, you know, the people who have been asking and answering the questions tend to have been people with penises, and they have been answering those questions in the way that they kind of want them answered, you know, or that they think they do. And as I note in the book, we didn't even really start to look at vaginas and a lot of animals, like, you know, how famous duck penises are. Everybody always talks about them, right? But it wasn't until I remember in graduate school in the 90s, in the mid 90s, you know, we talked about duck penises. That's how, you know, it's been going on for at least a quarter of a century. But it wasn't until 2005 when Patricia Brennan, who's at Mount Holyoke, was working on anatomy and decided that, you know, we need to look at the vagina here because duck penises have these corkscrew shapes. And the whole idea is if you have, you know, sort of forced copulation, which is what these ducks do because they have these ballistic corkscrew shaped penises. It's just they come in there, they fire that thing off and they leave. Then the idea is there's some kind of an evolutionary dance taking place there, like a call and response, that if that's what's happening with the penis, then you should have some kind of adaptations. There should be, you would expect them in the vagina that kind of are counterpoint to that because this is forced copulation. But she was the first person to look at this. And that was in 2005. And yes, she did find that there are, you know, are these adaptations, apparent adaptations in the vagina with cul-de-sacs and even corkscrews that go the other direction as though to unscrew the you know, forced copulatory penis. And, you know, 2005 after, you know, centuries of, you know, poking around on the external genitalia on the other side. So
it's pretty amazing that, I mean, it's not though. That's the thing. It's like, you always want to be kind of like, what? And then you're like, of course. And of course it was she is the one who studied this. But it's still like, it is kind of weird to me that like such a large percentage, for example, of OBGYNs are male still. You know, so obviously there has been some sort of historical drive, like some men were interested in female anatomy, female reproduction. Obviously, their lens is probably very different than generally speaking, a woman's lens as she's and here we're still talking probably about like just cisgender people. Obviously, a very different lens too. If an individual is transgender and is like has a more complex and interesting kind of you know, view on gender, but it is kind of bizarre to me that more men historically weren't interested in female anatomy. Like, was it just that it was discounted? Was it just that it was like, oh, it must be simple, or maybe it's a black box, it's too complicated?
It's interesting, and this isn't just about in humans, but in non-human animals as well. Like, repeatedly, you find in the literature, well, one example I give is this guy who wrote a thing about the gonorrheas, is what he called it, several hundred years ago. And he spent a long time talking about the penis and gonorrhea, even though he kind of blamed the vagina for it. Like, he thought that that was the seat of gonorrhea, but he only spent like a few hundred words on it. And then he goes on to spend like thousands of words on the penis. And so even though he thought that this was where the disease originated, that the vagina was where it originated, he didn't really spend a lot of time thinking, talking, or writing about it, at least in this book. And when you look across it, not, you know, how they worked with non-human animals, you see something really similar. And there's a review that I used because it was a famous embryologist wrote it. And this is in, you know, the late 20th century. And he's like, you know, we just figure maybe the female side of this is just not that interesting. There's probably not anything going on there. It wasn't really like, we've looked and there's not anything. We're just like, which makes no sense because they're also at the same time arguing that there's some kind of co-evolution going on, you know, between what gets intromitted and what receives it, but they don't look at the receiving end of things to see what's changing there. It's kind of doesn't make biological sense that they ignored it for so long.
It's just, and also obviously all of the kind of socio-cultural implications of like female genital anatomy being responsible for these like really sexist kind of psychological constructs like hysteria and, you know, these ideas that like basically women's minds are possessed by their vaginas and their vaginas make them crazy or they make them inconsolable or too irrational, you know, neurotic. But of course, I think that that even persists to this day. And I don't think that that's only a one-way street. I think we often even hear women, for example, minimizing the male experience and saying, oh, just it's because he's full of testosterone. Like he thinks with his dick, he whatever, like as if he doesn't have his own mind.
Right. And I actually wrote an op-ed about this in Scientific American a few weeks ago, but we do have an issue with that. And I sort of roll that up with this idea of impossible masculinity because people on both sides of whatever aisle we have now, I'm not sure if it's an aisle, it's more like a canyon, but anyway, will, if you see a guy walk into, or you see a picture of a guy who's walked into a Starbucks, dangling an AR-15 off his back, you know, or driving a giant Hummer or whatever, you know, and people who consider themselves progressives will say small dick energy there. But, you know, I mean, really, you're going to take this, this is a human behavior that is sitting at the intersection of a lot. I'm not forgiving these people or excusing them. I'm just saying it's a behavior that sits at the intersection of a lot of pressures. You know, it's performative. It is for an audience that's, you know, partly the Starbucks, but an in-group somewhere out there. They're hoping, you know, they'll impress with this behavior. And where are these pressures coming from? I think that's worth asking rather than reducing that human being to a penis, to a body part like that.
Right.
So, and it is a two-way street. They'll say, oh, he's sticking it with his dick. You know, whereas we are, I mean, people who have uteruses, you know, they're thinking with their uteruses, they're hysterical.
Yeah.
And these things is okay.
It's not. And I wonder, I mean, and again, not to justify, but I wonder if the general difference here is that a historical view was a literal understanding of that statement, thinking with her, you know, uterus, like that they actually thought that that was like an ultimate vessel of control, whereas a more modern view is almost like a synecdoche. It's like I'm saying that it's his dick that's clouding his judgment. I'm not really meaning it's his physical dick. I mean that he's like toxically masculine, or he's like overcome. You know what I mean?
Right. So, it's a symbolic for that. I sure, like I guess that's an entirely reasonable interpretation, but it's still terrible.
Totally agree.
I mean, words have meanings, and when you try to encapsulate something really complex, and you do it, not you personally, but we do it in this reductive way, I don't think it does anybody any favors.
Absolutely. So, I mean, kind of stepping back a little bit from the from the kind of big picture understanding and you know, where you go in the book to try and put a lot of these things together and make inferences, maybe stepping back and starting the conversation about what we've learned from the animal kingdom, what we know about, let's say, biological sex differences than what I think a lot of the general public sort of make assumptions about, or like, what are some of the fundamental things that you wrote about in the book? Let's maybe a good starting point would be one that you already mentioned, that there are plenty of species where the male and the penis don't necessarily go hand in hand.
Right. The biggest, the two examples that people may recall having read about fairly recently are these cave insects that have been discovered. The partner that makes the eggs, right, the ovulator, right, has a structure that I decided I couldn't come, you can't call everything a penis because there are so many different names for these things, and because they don't occur on just one sex, and because a lot of animals aren't just a single sex, I needed to come up with some kind of word to like capture this use throughout the book. And the word that I came up with was intromitum, because this is intromission, it's inserting something into something else. And so that's just kind of this neutral term. So the ovulator in these two species has an intromitum that it inserts into a partner, and the partner has something that's very much like a vagina, but the partner makes the sperm. And the ovulator inserts this intromitum into the partner and basically draws the sperm up into themselves. And it's like a little sperm vacuum. And that, of course, is not how most people would think about things, right? Most people would think that, oh, there's a male and that male has a penis and that's how you know that's a male.
Right. Yeah. But, that's kind of been the taxonomy forever.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. And I use it as a shorthand in the book. There's no question that's what I do because that's the language we have now. But I feel like we need better language. I think ovulators is something that people use quite a bit just to sort of get around that. There are other terms that we can use. But again, language means things. And when we make this assumption, we are contorting what nature is actually doing. When we make the assumption that if that's a thingy that sticks out right, and transmits gametes, then the animal with that thingy is male. And that's just not the case. You see this also with apparently a lot of like mites, which I didn't see that one coming. But anyway, a bunch of mites that also have these sort of, they're like little sperm vacuums. Another thing that you see reversed is I think people have this idea that when it comes to copulation, that the perceived male of the species is the aggressor. And that also is not the case. You see a lot of the ovulator of the species being the aggressor. And the fun thing is because this always has to go apparently through kind of a male gaze or whatever, is that it's always considered a reversal. Every time they talk about it, they're like, oh, this is reversed. It's like, right. But, you know, reversed for whom? Because for the species, this is how this is. So
they didn't switch somewhere.
Like, wake up one morning and go, hey, let's just make things interesting here, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You see that a lot with I've talked about this quite a bit on the show, just this idea of like ethnocentric monoculturalism, which is a big mouthful way to say basically that like because most Americans in power historically were like white cis Protestant men, that was normative. So anything that is not that was other or different or aberrant or, you know, the minority. And when you view things through that lens of like this is what's quote normal, and then this other thing is, like you said, a reversal or a shift or a whatever, then all of a sudden, you start to add value judgments to it. And it's like a natural human thing to do to say, well, that's not normal. Therefore, something must be wrong with it.
Right. Exactly. And it has to be called out as such with language that is used that way. So,
And that's problematic because what does normal mean, right? That's like also a construct. So it's not normal, but it's absolutely natural. Like you just mean it's not the majority. Like it happens, it's less often, but it totally just happens. Nobody did that to these organisms. They developed these traits via evolution, just like every other organism on the planet. I've heard before, like the term hemipenis. I can't remember. Does that refer to like hyenas? Do they have a similar situation going on?
No, that's hemipenises in reptiles. Snake. Yeah, the snakes and lizards, they have a sort of two-headed penis.
That's what hemi means. Two-headed.
Yeah, it's a half penis. And echidnas have four-headed penises. I mean, just on fun side of this, there's just so many interesting things, you know. There's like all this heavy social stuff, but there's also just a lot of just like wow science things happening.
Oh my gosh, can we get a few more of those wow science things, because they're so much fun. Like what are some of the weirdest, and I shouldn't even say weird because again, value judgment, but some of the like most interesting kind of like really like what things that you came across in your research?
Well, I would have to say that the seed beetle, I kind of made the seed beetle like a little character in this book because it's kind of a recurring character through the chapters, because they have these penises that have spikes and little jaws. In fact, somebody described in this one species of them the enigmatic jawed genitalia. So, sure. I mean, you can imagine. And yes, I'm doing this absolutely, of course, through my human eyes because, I mean, what a choice do I have? I'm not a seed beetle. But they, when they copulate, they leave these little V-shaped marks on the inside of the ducts of the partner. And, you know, that's harm, right? That's damage. But then what you find out later is that the ejaculate, you know, people probably don't think of ejaculate this way, but it actually contains a lot of nutrients. And it may, and so females that experience this, I'm sorry, their partner that experiences this damage can draw up more nutrients possibly through these damaged walls. And they do tend to have more offspring. and to mate again. They don't live as long, but they have more offspring. So,
interesting. Yeah. Seems like a lot of insects have some cool stuff going on.
Yeah, they really do. The insects, they win hands down. That was one of the things, like another life lesson is we, you know, our penis is made for fun. There's just no question about it. You get, it's as, there were some rules that they laid down in early Christianity about don't put your penis in a tree, or what kind of trouble do you get into? Like, what's the worst thing you can do? And apparently putting your penis in a tree is kind of middle of the road, right? So clearly we can put our penis in like lots of things, but you know, if you're a seed beetle, you really can't. You can put it to this, you know, the partner, and that's kind of it. So one of the lessons is that you see a lot of just this array of ornamentation, and sometimes the researchers call this armature, because apparently this is always a battle. it's all the time, right? It's just called armature. It's armored up penises. Anyway, this array of, you know, like they look like maces and scrub brushes, and they have spikes on them and a little, just lots of little features. We don't have that, but we get to have a little more fun. You know, but yes, the insects have, they got it going on with this stuff. There's no question.
It's so sad, though, because it's almost impossible not to see the sort of, like, you know, mentioned male gaze. I wish we could come up with some words that have, like, all these terms that I think are actually really informative, like male gaze or like toxic masculinity. They've become sort of such charged, and I guess they've always been really charged, but you know, this sort of like male perspective or whatever, even when you're talking about the insect penises and the armatures and the spikes and the whatever, you wonder if somebody else had looked at that under the microscope for the first time and had said, oh, it looks like botanical, or it looks very, you know, it's like a different interpretation of the exact same thing that you're looking at.
Yes, I do. I wonder about that a lot. Like how, so in part of the book, I do, I think I write about, was it a mole or the hyena? I mean, I actually wrote about a lot of these things, but you mentioned hyenas earlier. The thing about hyenas that's really interesting is they have an exceptionally long clitoris. It's really long, and they give birth through it, which it has to go through a curve, and it's really narrow. And you know,
sounds really painful.
To me personally, it sounds uncomfortable and painful. But but the thing is that they don't, it's not called, like, I feel like if I had discovered this, I would have been like, damn, that right there is an amazing clitoris, right?
Yeah, it'd be like a super clit.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah. But that's not how it's referred to. And instead, in the literature, researchers will call it things like a large clitoral pseudopenis.
Pseudopenis. Yeah. Yes, that's what the word I was thinking of.
Pseudopenis. Yes. Instead of just like, you know, monster clitoris, super clitoris, you know. And so my, you know, sort of joke in the book is, well, I guess if I had been in charge of that, maybe, and I had found a penis on something, maybe I would have decided to call it a short penile pseudoclitoris.
Right.
Because I'm the one doing the naming now. Thank you very much. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Totally language agree. Matters. Yeah.
Language matters. And it's just so apparent, this kind of constructivist view, or like you were talking about, like epistemology earlier, ways of knowing that, like, the person doing the work gets all the power in terms of how it's recorded in history. And sometimes it's just a function, as I mean, we know this, we know these psychological constructs that, for example, when Andrew Wakefield, you know, said, vaccines cause autism, and people go, holy crap, vaccines cause autism. And then it was like, no, they don't. Here are literally hundreds of studies showing that they don't. Here's literally thousands of people saying he was wrong. People, the retraction just doesn't reverberate through culture the same way.
Right.
And it's so frustrating. So it's like the first person who saw the thing and wrote about the thing and, you know, got people to listen to him, generally speaking, that thing, the way that they interpret it, that's what sticks against the wall. And unfortunately, historically, it was mostly hymns.
Yeah, it's hard to peel it off. And the thing is they aren't, you know, they're not the first person, right, at all. Right. Lots of people who see these things and have noted them, and it's part of their culture and, you know, their interaction with where they live. And they, you know, these are things that they know extremely well. But if they don't have the power, the conduit, the access to broadcast it, then the what they know doesn't get out. And like you say, the people who do have those things, they're the ones whose interpretation of it gets the traction. And it's, you know, like the way, I mean, Wakefield is still around, right? Mm-hmm. And still saying things. And that was 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago that came out. And there have been thousands of yeah. you know, studies. So it's extremely hard to peel that thing off the wall once it gets stuck there.
Yeah. And it's just like, I think the point that you made almost like definitely bears repeating, in the sense that I've been always trying to be very careful. And it was sort of a personal awakening that I realized that it's such an easy thing to say. It's such a common thing to say, this new animal or a new discovery or whatever. And it's like, you have to really caveat that and say new to Western science or a newly named animal within the scientific literature, because, like, of course, indigenous people or even just local people who have lived in those areas knew about these organisms. Like, they've seen them. They've been a part of their life for many times, you know, multiple generations. But of course, it's like that Eddie Izzard stand-up where he talks about colonialism and going to these places and being like, we claim this for Mother England. And they're like, you can't claim us. We live here. And he's like, but do you have a flag? You know? It's like, it's such a horrible concept, but it's weird that it's not weird. We know exactly why, but it's frustrating that even in 2020, it's like so normative to the point where people don't even realize that the way that we talk is like horrifically offensive to massive groups of people who were slaughtered in genocide or who had all their rights removed or, you know, gosh, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, they had names for these things, already. And I think Western scientists show up and they're like, ooh, I discovered the thing, I shall name it, you know, and so that's the name that sticks. And I do see people making fun of things like decolonize the syllabus and decolonize science. But the thing is that that's fair. That's a fair thing to do. It is almost literally the least that you could do after so many decades, centuries of especially Western scientists just erasing people.
You're so right. It is literally like I guess the least you could do is nothing and keep perpetuating, which is what most people do. But yeah,
one
it's like
step up from the least, you know.
Totally. We're not talking even reparations. We are talking reparations, but decolonizing a syllabus is literally just thinking about things more deeply, like through a lens, and writing about them in a way that you're at least attempting not to be horrifically insensitive and offensive.
Yeah, and erasing. I think, you know, it is a huge, it is a crime, I think, to erase other human beings and their knowledge and understanding, and not, I think, especially in academia, where everybody's intellectual property is so important to them and they don't want somebody else stepping all over that. But then to accept that you could erase the intellectual property of people who have had this in their lives for, you know, generations, for centuries, and be just fine with that, that seems intellectually dishonest to me.
Right. And of course, what it really is like just a massive exercise and show of privilege. And it's frustrating that, again, even the word privilege has become really kind of charged and whatever. But ultimately, that's what it is. If you have lived your entire life not even having to think about stuff like this, not even knowing, because that's what erasure is about, right? Is you have to sometimes have your own personal identity or intellectual awakening where you're like, I didn't fucking even know that. Nobody taught me that. Shit, now that I know, like, everything is different. And then the idea, and that right there is privilege, sure, but it's, I think the privilege becomes toxic when somebody then comes to those realizations and says, but it's too much burden for me to change my behavior now that I am aware of it. Like, I'd rather be comfortable and not inconvenienced. My own convenience is more important than somebody else's, you know, cultural identity or history. Like, that's when it becomes like a
fucked up exercise in privilege.
Well, right. One is the sin of omission. It's a privilege to not have to know these things. But the other is the sin of commission, because now you know it, but you're doing nothing because it's too much work.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's kind of like, you know, speaks to a lot of these other social issues like Me Too and, you know, kind of entrenched systemic racism, which is that silence is violence, is that, you know, if you are aware of these things and you sit back and you don't do your part to prevent them or to protect individuals or even just to be allies, you're actually a part of the system that's perpetuating the violence. And that's, it's just...
That's probably why you're not doing anything, because if you were threatened... then you would do something. So I think that a lot of people probably don't act because the system is supporting, it's benefiting them.
You're so right.
If they act, they probably feel they're acting against themselves.
It's like when people say they're not political, like, oh, I'm just not political, I don't pay attention. It's like, yeah, that's a massive privilege, because that means that whoever is in power, whatever legislative agendas are on the table, like, literally do not affect you. Like, how could anybody feel that way? But I guess that's what it means to be sort of in that class of individuals for whom you kind of know that it doesn't matter who the politician in power is, they're probably looking out for you.
If you're not under threat, then it's easy to be not political.
Yeah. Ugh, God. And so it's so interesting that I think I don't want to say it's seemingly innocuous, because your book is about the dick. And, like, you know, it's like, I'm sure that even the title was really well thought. The artwork in it was really well thought. But what I love about it is that I don't want to say that it's a bait and switch, because you definitely didn't do that. This is a deep dive into your historical research, which focuses on the penis. But the fact that in presenting stories about the penis, what you're ultimately doing is helping to reveal the lack of stories and the lack of scientific interest in the vagina or in the ovaries or in reproduction from a, let's say, female, or I don't even want to simplify it to female, but from a non-historically normative perspective. I love that you did that. That somebody who maybe is a little bit big dick energy or small dick energy or whatever the fuck we were saying people call them, might pick a book like this up, because they're like, that's about a dick. That sounds interesting. And then learn about the non-dicks or the other, I don't know. Oh, God, it's like we can't even avoid the landmine.
We need to refresh our language, but for sure. So there is a footnote in the book. I think the footnote just says Trojan horse alert.
I love that.
I did. So there's some irony here, but it seems internally inconsistent, because, you know, one of the goals of the book is to decenter the penis, and it's a book about penises, but the central chapter in the book is actually about vaginas and about the other side of what I call the genitalic handshake in the book. And so, yes, there's some subtle, wait, what's this thing over here?
Right.
I want to draw the reader's attention to something that's not a penis. And also just contextualizing where the human version lands and what the patterns look like. You know, penises are less adorned, and the species tend to have more boxes to check before they can approach each other and become intimate. And ours kind of falls on that side of things, not just kind of, it very much does. Whereas the tendency is, when they're very adorned, the species has what we view as forced copulation, and what some people have characterized as a sexual arms race, because everything is always a war. But it's more kind of a co-evolution between one side of the genitalia and the other side of that handshake, and this back and forth that occurs. And so you see a lot more ornamentation on the penises. What you see on the vaginas, we don't know as well, because that is what I point out in the middle chapter of the book. So,
You know, something comes up for me, which is like, I guess it's like, do I want to editorialize on this? Maybe I do. I'm interested in your take, because I think you hear this kind of neutralized language with animals very often, because what you don't want to do is add a sort of value judgment to an organismal experience. You don't want to anthropomorphize it at all. And so you say things like forced copulation, whereas, you know, so historically, like, it's beyond the pale to say this animal is raping that animal, but it's totally fine to say this animal has a pseudo penis. Right. Like that's right. The thing where I get a little bit frustrated or confused about the scientific kind of story.
Sure. I decided it's funny you ask about rape because, well, first of all, I decided not to use rape for this in the book, although I do see it in a lot of news stories when they talk about like duck penises and things like that, because that's a legal construct. And it even varies from culture to culture how it's defined and perceived. And so that's why I decided to kind of run around it and use forced copulation instead, because that seems pretty objective that that's what's happening, is that it's forced and it's copulation.
But it almost makes it feel like there's no quote victim, and maybe there is no victim situation.
It's hard to say, right? Because these are non-human animals. I don't know if a female mallard, you know, feels victimized. She's definitely, because I've seen this happen, you know, she certainly tries to get away, but what level, I mean, this is all life history adaptation. Mm-hmm. And so I can't, you know, just step in with my sort of human opinions about it and wag a finger at the mallard and say, you should stop trying to rape her, you know? So, but it's interesting you ask that, because when this proposal was going around, one one comment I got back was that it wasn't rapey enough, kind of like, she's not really bringing up rape here. She's just calling it this thing. And you know, and I was just like, that was unexpected.
That is weird.
You know, sort of a critique to be, well, this isn't rapey enough.
Okay.
See what I can do about that for you.
Yeah, I mean, because that's really the thing, right, is that there are individuals out there, and I got to say that I really respect them. And I've interviewed so many of them on my show who are just like these singularly focused, like, just beautiful nerds who spend their entire lives like studying the life history of the honeybee or the life history of the whatever. And like they're really able to do everything they can to be as unbiased as possible as they view these things. But of course, I think as a general consumer, we're going to read popular science literature and we're going to say, how does that affect me? How do I relate to this experience? Yeah. And of course, we cannot help but conceptualize things through our own personal lens. And so I think that what's really cool about the way that you approached this story was to not try and prevent that, but to just embrace it and say, yes, of course, this is how we're, of course, this has a lot of social political connotation. Let's dig through the science. Let's be as objective as possible, but say, how does that make us feel? How does that affect us? How does that help us conceptualize our own relationships and our own lived experience as a, let's say, cis man or as a trans woman or as a, you know, bisexual, non-binary individual. So I think it's really cool that you took that approach. Was that like a conscious effort, or is it like, oh, I just can't help but kind of think and write that way?
It's both. I've always thought that way. And so then I consciously wrote that way for sure. I was like, okay, I need to make sure I bring this tendency I have to these pages. You know, it's interesting because I think the reason that we do put ourselves that way is because we're a social species. We use empathy, right, to interact with each other, to read each other, to tell ourselves from other people and that kind of stuff. And
this is a good thing.
Usually a good thing. And if it's not there, that's a bad thing.
Right.
And so this is a very human tendency. But I have a really good example of how you can become mistaken about it. There's a story that I have in there about a northern elephant seals. We went to watch them as a family, and we watched this whole thing happen where there was a female and she starts they flip their pinnipeds, right? And so she starts running away, except on flippers, hump, hump, hump across the beach. These two males kind of triangulate on her. They're clearly trying to copulate with her, and she's like, get off me. And she's like flipping sand at him and all this other stuff. And we're just like, oh my gosh, what's happening here? And she's being attacked. And then all of a sudden, this huge male just explodes out of a sandbar in front of us and just charges straight toward her. And these other two males take off. And then there's copulation. And we're just like, what? And it looks, from our perspective, bad. It looks like, oh my gosh, she is just being like, you know, ganged up on and all this other stuff. Turns out this is a sorting process. The northern elephant seal females, they move out and they sort out lesser males. They're the males approach them, the female, but then they sort of have to fight with each other and they're not as strong and they're not the biggest male there. And eventually the biggest male does show up and she allows the copulation. Like when you start to really look at their behavior, you see that she positions herself and sort of all this other stuff. But from our perspective, like we were kind of stunned.
We were
like on the way out, we're like unpacking it. Like, well, is that rape, you know, and all these other things. And then later on, I read about their behaviors. So like, that's exactly what we saw. It was a sorting process that was going on. And the ranger there told us the day before that it happened in the parking lot. And that she goes, there was blood everywhere. Children were screaming. And we were just like, oh my God, you know. But, you know, like to us, that's just like a horror show, right? But it's part of this life history strategy to sort out and end up with the dominant male.
It is interesting that as individuals or even as trained scientists who have tried our best to approach problems from multiple angles and think outside the box and blah, 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 still have to remember that there are these like macro and there are these micro and there are these, you know, kind of individualistic experiences. And then there's like the species as a whole. And when it comes to evolution, like you can't just look at one pairing or one kinship group, one family, one whatever. There are these trends in the population that contribute to these changes over time. But I think it's so easy to think about things through a human lens and say there's so much like personal taste and preference and blah, blah, blah. And maybe that is the case with certain animals, or maybe those kind of natural drivers overwhelm any sort of decision making on a local level. But what a complicated endeavor to try to understand mating behavior, gender behavior, biological set. Is gender even a construct in certain organisms? You know what I mean?
Right,
it's a lot.
Yeah. And we tend to be really reductive and categorize things. And so we have limitations and we live within those limitations. It's always a good exercise to try to push against them and see where that takes you, I think.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So I'm thinking of some like kind of big takeaways from your book. You know, we've talked a little bit about sort of the historical investigation of the penis or the vagina or, you know, other terms for maybe what we consider things that don't fall in within those perfect taxonomic categories. Who was doing the investigation? Why? How was it driven? We've talked a little bit about evolution, but maybe we can come back to some of these conversations that we were having in the beginning about that phrase toxic masculinity. Like, what does it mean? How do you see it? Is it a phrase you like to use? And how has your understanding of the scientific literature actually, in many ways, contributed to kind of the social cultural utilization of these kind of behaviors?
I've opted to use impossible masculinity instead of toxic masculinity because I don't really like to see the poison yoked to masculinity that way. And I do think that what the real problem is that there's this impossibility that's been set up and that society sort of tries to shape young men, boys and men, to meet that and then shape girls and women to cater to it. And
interesting. So it's almost like we've done such a good job, I think, in the popular literature of talking about the impossible beauty standards of women,
right,
or the impossible roles, like, oh, how can I be a mother and a wife and also have my own career and, you know, all these things. But you're right. We generally just denigrate the sort of male gaze or the male kind of aggressive, however
we
want to conceptualize.
We call it toxic.
Yeah, instead of saying like we expect men to never show their emotions or anger's the only acceptable emotion. We teach little boys when they're young that they're not allowed to cry. We expect them to be caretakers, providers, and never ever show, quote, weakness.
Right.
That is, and it's impossible.
And how we define weakness is against that backdrop as well, because there are all kinds of weaknesses, right?
So, yeah, massive weakness is maybe not being able to say I love you, or not being able to find joy outside of work, but we don't consider
every
that weakness.
Strength has a corollary weakness, right? Yeah. So otherwise it wouldn't be a strength, it would just be. So
yeah,
you know, these things have to have their opposites. So I think of it as impossible masculinity, and I think that one of I open the book with a chapter about, you know, penis and penis size and satisfaction in partners and that kind of thing. And, you know, the real takeaway is that penis size is not nearly as important for partner satisfaction as attention to the partner and the partner's needs. And,
right,
you know, the insertion is not even necessary. But what I really want to get across, like the life lessons part of it from the NLP, is besides just contextualizing ours and this vast array of things that can become so intricate, is that there's not, if you look at animals, and even if you just, let's take the straight binary of male and female, you do not see this just common, you know, just across the board, specific behaviors that you consider masculine, specific behaviors you would consider feminine, you know, across the board. In all animal species, it's all over the place. It's just all over the place. And, you know, we have the wrong ideas about things, partly, I think, because of phrases like survival of the fittest. People think, you know, they equate this with, like, you know, a muscle instead of
a trait that fits,
right? Right. You know, they equate it with winning and having some kind of level of strength. And that's not what that means at all. It's more fit like a puzzle piece into your environment. And, you know, perfect is the enemy of the good there. It's just, do you fit enough to reproduce and pass your, you know, in the population, pass gene variants along? So I think we need to reconstruct. There are lots of masculinities and they're not all impossible and a lot, and they're valid. We can express these things. Any of us, not just those with penises, in all kinds of ways. And I think we need to refresh that vocabulary as well.
I love that. I mean, and in so many ways, you know, what I see, my lens here is that somebody might hear what we're talking about or just like a little snippet of this conversation out of context, or they might read an editorial about your book or something like that and only read the headline or take just the, you know, the lead and take it out of context and say, oh, this is like radical feminism. She's a feminazi. She's whatever. But ultimately, you're actually advocating for a healthier and more respectful way that we as a society treat men.
Ding, ding, and, ding.
Yeah. Like, this is so important. And it's so lost sometimes in the violent and aggressive tribalism that exists. Oftentimes when we talk about tribalism in our society and culture, we're talking about religious tribalism, ethnic tribalism, cultural tribalism. We very rarely use that term when we talk about gender.
Sure. Yeah. And I've read that maybe we should come up with, speaking of refreshing vocabulary, something that maybe doesn't call it tribalism, which makes that sound like a bad thing when it's, you know, historically for lots of people, lots of cultures is a great thing. But I had this experience, one you're just describing, Kara, just the other day. I tweeted something about my book and about sort of some of the messages in it. And do you remember the people who did the conceptual penis paper, that fake paper about the penis and the climate change? So the guy who did that paper, he sort of, you know, he retweeted my tweet and did something trying to make fun of it. And the irony there is he clearly hadn't read the book, which is hilarious because the whole thing about the conceptual penis paper is that, you know, in the social sciences, whatever, they're not paying any attention and they just publish whatever. so I was like, okay, dude. But anyway, and a lot of people, you know, his followers or whatever in his in group came in and, oh Lord, the things that they said were just, first of all, just hilariously untrue, but just a lot of, you know, they just, you are hairy legged. I mean, I don't know how old some of these people are because some of their attempts at slurs were really like boomer level. But, you know, do you have a lot of cats? You've never encountered a penis in your life. You know, look how ugly you are. You look like a potato and all of these other things.
It's like, ooh, all right.
The potato one was really funny because actually my head is much more like a pumpkin than a potato. So they were off. But anyway, and the thing is that I kind of, you know, the irony of that is that this book is kind of about people who are like them, who feel this pressure that's so strong that their valve is to just come out and attack a total stranger for no reason because they feel right. some sort of level threat level that doesn't exist. Isn't that terrible? Like, I just Absolutely. Feel like that's just terrible. That's a waste of emotions and anger and time, right? For that to be that way. So I would love to see some change around that for men.
Absolutely. I mean, it's heartbreaking. And, you know, it yes. brings me back to a recommendation that I've made on the podcast several times. I'm a massive documentary nerd, and I probably watch at least one documentary every day, which is insane.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Not nice. Always a full-length film. Sometimes it'll be a documentary series where I'll only have like a 30-minute kind of shorter documentary. But I do. I consume a lot of docs, and I feel like I'm running out all the time, and it makes me sad. But I keep coming back to this one doc called The Mask You Live In by Jennifer Siebel Newsom. And I highly recommend it to anybody who's interested in this concept, because she really tells a story, not so much through the biological science, like you do such a beautiful job of doing, and sort of the natural history component of it, but she enters it through like child rearing. And she talks basically about this unrealistic expectation we put on our men and boys, and how as children, they internalize a lot of these traits. And actually, there's a direct link to violence in society as adults. Like, there's a direct link to domestic violence. There's a direct link to violent crimes like rape and murder and, you know, intimate partner violence, because of the way that we don't give men and boys outlets for expressing their, you know, emotions, because right. of the way that men and boys are basically pressured by society to not be able to cry, to not be able to say, I need, I want, I hope. And it's heartbreaking. And it's just a beautiful encapsulation of so many of the themes that you touch on in your book that I can't help but recommend both Jen's doc and, of course, Emily, your book, Fallacy. It's just wonderful. And I'm so happy that we've had the opportunity to talk today. You know, I always close my show by asking the same two questions of my guests. But before we dive into that part, I wanted to know, do you feel like that was a good kind of button? Or is there anything else that you were like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe we didn't talk about this. I have to at least mention it.
Oh, no, that was great. This was a really good conversation. I enjoyed it.
Yay. Oh, I'm so glad. Okay. So I always ask my guests at the end of the show one kind of big picture bummer question and one big picture sort of like silver lining question. So I'm really interested to hear your thoughts, especially because we're actually recording this on October 20th. Let me see when the air date is. I have my calendar set, because this may actually come out after the election, which is like, no, it comes out the day before election day.
Okay.
So, you know, obviously, if that's part of the context, that's perfectly understandable and acceptable. So the first question is, when you think about the future and whatever context is relevant to you right now, and there's a lot of relevant contexts in our world, number one, what is the thing that's like legit keeping you up at night, that you're worried about, that you're frustrated by, maybe cynical about, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then on the flip side of that, what are you genuinely, like authentically excited for, looking forward to, you know, maybe even optimistic about? Like, what do you have good, pure feelings about?
This is two sides of the same coin, actually. So the bad side is that, I think we can see this happening all around, is this last stand, I think, among regressives who want to uphold the systems that favor them. Right. And the fact that they are doing just about every underhanded and criminal thing they can think of to try to make that happen. That is extremely demoralizing to see. It looked like we were making some pretty good progress. And then, you know, to run up against these desperate efforts and to see that in some quarters they are succeeding is demoralizing. And it does worry me and it does keep me up at night. But the flip side of that is that what's coming up behind them is a wave. Mm-hmm. And it is I love young people so much. I teach and I have always been a teacher because I just, when you see what young people are doing and how they talk about things and think about things, you see them coming up behind it. And it is a wonderful, wonderful new world that is coming up behind this last stand. So once we topple those people, and we get them out of the way, these young people can come in and the world and its progress can continue. And I see mm-hmm. that as a huge bright spot.
Oh, I love that. I love it. And it gives me hope as well. And I think that it's not just lip service. It's not just like one of those, oh, I have to say this because, you know, everything sucks and we're on fire and whatever. And like, but ultimately there is example after example. There's so much evidence to show that people give a shit, that yeah. people are working really hard, collaboratively, progressively to affect change. And, you know, A, the old guard is always going to die. We know that. We know this is how revolution or even just evolution occurs. Mm-hmm. And B, like, I do think personally that, you know, and I say this all the time on the show, like what is the MLK quote that the moral arc of justice, you know, the yeah. moral arc is long, but bends towards justice. Yeah. yeah. And I truly believe that. It doesn't always feel like it because unfortunately it doesn't always happen within a single generation. So we don't right. get to see as much progress as we'd like within our lifetime.
And meanwhile, people die, which is horrible. I mean,
absolutely. Right. It's horrible.
They die because of it.
For sure. And that's heartbreaking. And so that's why I do think it's so important that we not only study science and not only read about philosophy and culture, but we study history. We have to know our own history.
Go humanities. I'm here. I have an English degree. I am a liberal arts heart. And I think that we always need to have our humanities to translate what we understand about the world.
Absolutely. Well, Emily, this has been such a joy. Everybody, her book is Fallacy, Life Lessons from the Animal Penis. Thank you so much for doing this with me.
Thanks so much for having me, Kara. That was a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.